Okay, thank you very much to all who are here for the reading by, or the talk with Richard Michelson, author of Lippman Pike, America's First Home Run King. We are live at the Bergino Baseball Clubhouse in the landmark cast iron building in Greenwich Village. And it is a pleasure to welcome Richard here. Normally, I don't read somebody's bio. We kind of just get into it. But I was so impressed by Richard's bio, I thought I should read a couple of sentences just to put in context who we're fortunate enough to have with us tonight. Richard Michelson is a full-time award-winning poet and children's book author and full-time gallery owner of R. Michelson Galleries in Northampton, Massachusetts. Fascinated by history, Richard's topics often deal with civil rights and racial issues, as well as Jewish subjects. Richard's book, As Good as Anybody, Martin Luther King and Abraham Joshua Heschel's Amazing March Toward Freedom, won the prestigious Sidney Taylor Award Gold Medal. In addition to his writing and gallery work, Richard is a popular guest speaker. Within the past few years, he has lectured and read from his works in India, Eastern Europe, and throughout the United States. His poetry has been praised by Elie Wiesel as, quote, deeply moving. The one thing I know is there is nothing I could say that would be any more intelligent than anything Elie Wiesel could say, so I'm not going to comment further, other than this is, I thought I was exhausted and busy, but reading this, I'm truly exhausted. It's amazing the energy and the talents you have.
It's a pleasure to be here. I thank you. I have to say I might have spoken in many places all over the world, but this is a first. This is very cool here at this clubhouse. We've got the New York City in the background, and it's a great building. It's really very, very cool. So it's a pleasure to be here.
Thank you. Thank you. Well, we welcome you to the landmark cast iron building, and Richard, again, is the author of this amazing, fascinating book called Lippman Pike, America's First Home Run King. It was illustrated by Zachary Pullen. For those of you listening at home or wherever you may be, all I can say is it's worth getting this book. Besides for Richard's tremendous story, the illustrations are really, really beautiful.
Zach did a great job.
Yeah,
really.
Beautiful.
And
beautiful.
We have some of the images up. I should probably send them to your website as well, but we have some of them on my website, which is richardmichelson.com, and that's Richard, M-I-C-H-E-L-S-O-N.com. If you click on the book cover, Lip Pike, you'll see a bunch of Zach's illustrations, which are just wonderful.
Yeah, terrific, terrific. And once, with the podcast, as you're listening, there'll be links, so you'll be able to find all this.
Great.
And it's published by Sleeping Bear Press, in case anybody wants to look it up that way. So let's start with a simple question. From what I've read, you are not really a baseball fan.
Uh-oh. We're talking to the wrong audience here.
So don't worry. There's no trivia questions here.
I have to say that my knowledge of baseball pretty much began and ended with the famous game that Sandy Kovacs did not pitch. That's pretty much it. I was not, I'm active. I love sports, but I'm mostly a... I bicycle ride, I play racquetball, handball. I was not involved in baseball. I have to say that coming to it through Lip Pike, I really found this subject through my interest in history. And I have an interest in people who break certain barriers, people who, like behind us, we see Jackie Robinson, and Lip Pike was, though many people assume it's Hank Greenberg, was the first Jewish baseball player. More than that, Lip was the first professional baseball player of anyone, the first person paid to play. So, I came to Lip through, finding his name as people who, did something different, entered the American dream through the world of baseball, and it's given me a new appreciation, actually, for what sports does to help integrate people into American culture.
Absolutely, and the most famous first would always be Jackie Robinson. Whenever
always.
You say the first with baseball, people think of Jackie Robinson, mm-hmm. and rightly so. I knew of Lippman Pike, it's
that's how I know I'm in good hands, because most people don't. I
probably would not have, though, if I didn't also know that he was Jewish. It's kind of one of these things where I follow every guy who's Jewish in Major League Baseball today and in history. And then when I read this little story about the first professional baseball player, which is fascinating in itself, what made him the first professional baseball player, and maybe you can get into that a little.
Sure. Well, I'll talk about that a little bit. Obviously, I guess the underhanded story is he was the first player caught or accused of accepting money to play under the table. I think that's, frankly, one of the reasons that he has been left out of a lot of baseball histories, a lot of Jewish histories. You have that Jewish money thing going on. But, in fact, in the my research and the reading about him, Lipp was the first player called in front of the board of baseball owners when it was an amateur league. Most people played in the town where they lived because they had their full-time job, and baseball was an amateur sport done for fun.
This is, we're talking 19th century.
We're talking, the first year of professional baseball was 1871. So a couple of years before that, Lipp was given $20 a week to go play for the Philadelphia Athletics. Even his mother said, "I can't believe anyone would be paid to chase a ball." This was kind of a new, a new concept. His dad wanted him to stay in the family haberdashery, which was in Brooklyn. And Lipp said to his dad, "You followed your dream. You came to America. This is my dream. I want to play ball." So he went to Philadelphia to play for the Athletics, and because it was a time when baseball was just starting to get fans, who were called cranks at the time, some of the managers started paying under the table some of the players who were the better players from the other teams to attract more cranks, more fans. And but Lipp found himself a Brooklyn boy all of a sudden in Philadelphia, a Jewish boy on a team that did not have any Jews. And when, we don't know today whether, how this came about, but the other teammates ganged up. He was the best player on the team, but still, in one of the local newspapers, they alleged that he was getting paid. So Lipp was called before the board of the Baseball Association. And what happened then was they asked some of the other team owners, et cetera, to show up to talk against this. But it turns out, of course, that every team was paying players under the table. Lipp was just the one focused on, because he was the Jew on the team. Instead of him being censured, they decided to change the rules. And that's how professional baseball began. The next year, they allowed people to be paid to play. And the following year was the beginning of the National Association of Professional Baseball Players. Lipp was hired by the Troy Haymakers to be the team captain, which was what managers were called at the time. They were playing managers. And so not only do we have the first professional ball player, the first Jewish ball player, he was also the first Jewish manager. And, and he's been left out of so many histories. And when people do know him, they know him as a Jewish ball player. But when you start looking at what he did and his stats, he should be in the Hall of Fame. I'm going next month to talk in Cooperstown, and I'm going to do my best lobbying effort.
When will you be at the Hall of Fame?
I'll be at the Hall of Fame at the end of June, June 28th. Thank you. I think that's a Tuesday. So anybody who's up in Cooperstown or come and say hello, come visit me. We'll be talking up there, and it should be great fun.
And hopefully you can try to get Lip closer to being in the Hall of Fame.
We're doing that. I'm also talking right now to the Jewish Sports Hall of Fame.
On Long Island. Right.
And so if you're listening out there at the Jewish Sports Hall of Fame, I'm coming after you too.
Absolutely. I know him, so you better be listening.
Okay. So, Lip was actually the home run king the first 2 years of professional baseball. I find very interesting, actually, is in the first year he tied, and he tied with another Jewish player. So the Jews were in charge of the league there. No, they were the power hitters. And the next year he actually got, and now well, for somebody who's not a baseball guy, here we go with the stats. I'm talking to you.
You're converted.
He actually hit 17.4%. of all the home runs in the entire league that year, and the only time that has been bested was Babe Ruth in 1920 when he hit 20% of all the homers in the league. So I think that we've got a good reason to stand behind Lip. He was a power hitter. He was also the fastest runner in the league, and later on in his career, he actually raced and beat a racehorse in a foot race, and he made some good money on that as a sideshow.
He was a talented, smart man, it sounds like.
He was a talented, smart man, and he was, his family, I have to say his father, from what we know, stood behind him. He had a brother named Boaz, who also made it to the Professional Baseball League and never quite starred as Lip did. And we're not sure of the records, but there appears to be a younger brother as well who played in one game. So it's an interesting family. The dad encouraged the boys in baseball and sports, but he also encouraged them to have pride in their Jewish identity. And at the time, Lip was loved by the Brooklyn Jewish community. This is great being in New York, isn't it? Okay. And at his funeral, which was written up in the Sporting News, they talked about how he was, how beloved he was in the Brooklyn Jewish community, in Town Hall. I have to say that one of the people paying him under the table was Boss Tweed.
Really? Wow.
So he also got a job at Tammany Hall, where he was told he'd have little to do during the day and plenty of time to practice ball. Boss Tweed actually brought him back from Philadelphia to New York to play for the New York team.
Wow.
And so he's an interesting fella and an important figure of the day. As far as I can tell, this is the first book written about him. And it's a children's book, but there's a lot more research to be done on Lip, and I think a lot more to say about him.
Well, what I found so interesting is, as you said, it is a children's book, and it's beautifully done. But his story is a very adult story in other ways. It brings in so many subjects, many of which you've just touched on, and you did a terrific job in the children's book. And I believe you're right. I don't think there has been another book about him.
Right.
And
I think one of the guilty little secrets of children's books, also as somebody who's written a number of them, and I do a lot of signings and a lot of speaking engagements, is how many adults are really buying them for themselves. And, sign it to, just sign them to me. and I think it's a great thing. There's some wonderful children's books out there in many different subjects. Some of our greatest artists today, in museum artists, people like Maurice Sendak, Leonard Baskin, Barry Mosher, some of the best known artists are illustrating children's books. Jules Pfeiffer and Kadir Nelson, who's done some great books, both with Sharon Robinson, Jackie Robinson's daughter, and also he has a wonderful children's book on the Negro Leagues, which I think is the best book written on that subject. It's just absolutely incredible. So, children's books, if they're done well, are a good entree into a subject, I think, for anyone, And then if you're if you want to take it a step further, certainly, you know, there's other places to go, but I wouldn't discount them.
No, absolutely. And this, I'm not sure if you know the answer to this question, if it came up in your research or not. I've never read anything about this, but just getting back for a moment to when Lip went in front of the board, and it became clear at that point that he was not the only one getting this money. Do you know if he kind of just spoke on his own or defended himself in front of this board, or how that transpired?
I don't know. I haven't been able to find any minutes of the thing. You know, I thank a lot of people in the front of this book. Some of the people from SABR really were very helpful. Robert Schaefer, I don't know if you know, did a lot of research on Lip and helped me out with that. But basically, until I hear further, the assumed judgment seems to be that that owners were supposed to come and challenge him, and nobody showed up. And so they did not have a quorum, and the reason that that we think that nobody showed up is everybody was guilty.
Right.
And everybody was hoping the other person would do the accusations. and I'm sure that on every team, it was most likely, just like today, I'm sure it was general knowledge that some folks were getting paid, some weren't. I think that Lip was a challenge, certainly as a Jewish man, but I think also partly because he was a foreigner from Brooklyn, brought to Philadelphia onto a team where everybody else worked together and knew each other from the community, and he was their best player. And I'm sure that resentment had a lot to do with it there as
right,
well.
Right. I would think so. Yeah. And let's talk a little bit about the story of his father and his mother, which you touched on a bit, about how his father, it seems as though his father wanted Lip to pursue baseball to help with assimilation, really.
Yeah, I think his father was a Dutch immigrant. And, we're talking about the 1850s. In this country today, of course, most of us are more familiar with the immigration waves that happened in the 1900s and the 1920s, and, of course, just before the Holocaust. But, Jews were coming to this country early on. When Lip's family came to Brooklyn, in the 1850s. In fact, more than half of the population were immigrants. So Brooklyn had a primarily immigrant population. At first, actually, Jews were welcomed into the neighborhoods because they needed businessmen, and was one of the opportunities open to Jews in Europe where it was in business. Most Jews knew how to read and how to add. It wasn't that usual. And so at first it really was not, it was a welcoming thing. Most of the immigrants at the time were Italian, Polish. So, there weren't that many Jews coming. So it was a small subset. They were trying to enter the mainstream, as most people were. One of the interesting dilemmas I had in writing the book is we really turned into a historian in many ways. Zach, who illustrated this book and is not Jewish, was wondering on some of the pictures when the boys are young. I'm holding this up so you can all look closely in your radio.
You don't know what you're missing.
Was whether to depict them wearing yarmulkes, not wearing yarmulkes, how they would have dressed during the day and in their dad's shop. And I couldn't advise him. So I did what I do on most of my books, is I started writing to some historians. In this case, I wrote to some rabbis to get different opinions And of course, as you know, if you ask Jews, you get different opinions. And everyone gave me a different opinion. So, some of the, we do know the synagogue that Lip attended. It was a Reform synagogue of the day. Some of the rabbis assumed that, again, it was a small population coming from Holland. They would have kept to themselves. Chances are they would have been wearing yarmulkes at the time. Others, of course, took the point that, well, they were trying to assimilate. They would not have. I finally called Jonathan Sarna, who is, I think, the historian extraordinaire over at Brandeis,
right,
who sent me some wonderful information that in fact, it really wasn't until after 1948 that it really became quite common for Jewish kids to wear yarmulkes out on the street. And before that, it tended to be rare. And in fact, many rabbis were not wearing yarmulkes at the time. It was I think, great Gaon Vilna rabbi who said it is okay to go bareheaded. So these are all the things that go into the illustrations of the book. For me, as the writer, I made my share of mistakes. At the first page, I had Lip working in his dad's haberdashery, and I had him standing behind the cash register, and as the customers come in, and it wasn't until I started doing some checking that I realized he was standing behind that cash register 2 years before the cash register was invented. So a lot goes into the book. I had to figure out the year of that, and then of course I had to look at every little detail to make sure it was historically correct, where they were walking, what they were doing. One of the things I did was I read a lot of the Brooklyn Eagles of the day, with the great Brooklyn newspaper, which did run box scores. And maybe your audience might know, I think the first great baseball newspaper writer was a young poet by the name of Walt Whitman, who wrote for the Brooklyn Eagle and encouraged the young men of the borough to go outside into the parks, breathe the fresh air, and learn to play the game of base, which is what it was called then, the game of base. And so for me, as a writer, as a poet as well, it was great to come across some of Walt Whitman's early commentary. Fascinating.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Once you start learning about a subject, and of course history is so important to me, there was just, it's endless.
Absolutely.
It's endless.
Yeah. And anything with history, but baseball, there's always something you never thought of or you never knew about, and it's fascinating. And you did a fantastic job. If you had to give a lesson from this book, whether to a child or to an adult, is there some lesson that somebody can take from the book, per se?
Well, I think the lesson and what I try to emphasize in the book, certainly, is that Lip was somebody who really followed his dream at a time when young Jews did not play baseball, and as a rule. He had this dream, he followed it, but he never turned his back on his community. And to me, that was important. He was somebody who knew where he came from. The hometown crowd loved him. Even though he played on teams, and back then, most players, once the professional baseball league started in 1871, and suddenly players could get paid, they would often go to a different team every year. So we really went from this neighborhood clubs to moving around. I think in a few years, Lip started the first year professional with the Troy Haymakers. He went to the Baltimore Canaries. He played in Hartford, Connecticut with the Dark Blues. Then he went to the St. Louis Brown Stockings, the Cincinnati Reds. We think free agents is a new thing, but the Providence Grays, the Worcester Ruby Legs, and he went then to the New York Metropolitans, where he played with the New York Mets in 1887. But he was always loved back in his hometown. So I think, you know, the lesson is, the lesson we should all follow in life is follow your dreams and don't forget where you came from. Can't go wrong.
That's a great lesson. Yep. That's a great lesson. And it apparently what he did was a forerunner to what baseball has become in recent times, where players do go to different teams. Yep. There were many, many years, many decades, where the owners had instituted the reserve clause, where a player was basically a slave to a team and he could never leave, till eventually it went all the way to the Supreme Court and other things happened, and it changed now where players do go.
It's funny how things come full circle.
Yeah,
it was also interesting to me, although this is not in the book, was how the game developed. You know, we tend to think today of the codified rules that we all know, you know, three outs, nine innings, etc. But you know, it was an evolution. They tried many different things. For a while, games were an hour, and whoever was ahead at the time was the winner. It sounds crazy today, but that's how we play football. It's how we play basketball. Then for a bit, rules were each team got the bat one time through the order, and that was your inning. Nine plays up, the next team would come up, and that didn't last too long. For a bit, it was based on ping pong rules, the first team to hit 21 runs. and you know, so it really evolved over time, and certainly we went from the ball changed for a bit. When Lip started playing, there was no gloves. You know, no baseball gloves. That was a later invention. And all that was fascinating for me to find out. We didn't have enclosed parks till much later. So a lot of people, when they hear that Lip won the batting crown with six homers, when I tell kids that, they all laugh. They think it's, you know, what's six homers? But it would be the equivalent today of hitting six inside the park home runs.
Right.
All of a sudden it becomes an achievement. So, again, all that was fascinating to me. I'm ready to write another book on baseball.
Absolutely. Come on back anytime. And how did, after Lip retired, what did he go on to do?
He went on to open his own haberdashery, just as his dad did. So he had a shop, and a lot of the local people would shop there to come and talk baseball. It was like, you know, sitting around the barber shop talking about things or the general store. And so that's, you know, where he went into. He died, I think it was 48 when he died. I don't have the date in front of me. I think it's in the book. But
48 years old.
48 years old, yeah. He did try one comeback. He actually, he played through 1881 steadily. Then he retired. He opened up his haberdashery. And in 1887, he was drafted back by the New York Mets to play again. I think he played in only one or two games. It was a disaster. He made like three or four errors in the game. You know, he was like bringing this old timer back in. And again, he was accused of another taint somewhat at the end of his career. He was accused of blowing the game on purpose. And you know, so that was not a great way to end up. He was an old guy when he came back. He hadn't played baseball for 7 years. I didn't know what they expected, but his teammates were upset. It didn't cloud in the long run his achievements. You know, of his day, he was the longest ball hitter, the best home run king, and the fastest runner in the league. Today, to have all those achievements, you know, it's very difficult. Not too many people win both the home run crown and steal the most bases every season.
Not unless you take steroids.
There you go.
Yeah. And does anyone have a question from our audience? Anthony?
Next week I'm going to Benton Harbor, Michigan. I'm going to be in Benton Harbor, Michigan. House of David Museum is out there. Has the House of David team recognized him for his accomplishments? Have you heard of the House of David? They were a Christian Israelite team.
Oh,
okay. Yeah. The House of David actually were not Jewish.
They were?
No. So they wore they had the long beard, so some people think they look like Hasidic rabbis or something.
I thought they were Christian Israelites. That's what they...
They were Christian, religious Christians, but they were not Jewish.
Oh, okay.
So I don't know. It's right. Interesting, though. It's possible that they may have some mention of him at this museum, which would be interesting.
Mm-hmm.
If they do, you can come back and we can do a podcast.
Let me know. That's the Jews for Jesus of their day.
Right.
Oh, is that
yeah.
So? Wow.
Yeah, they would barnstorm around the country.
Right.
Because they were so... They had supposedly they had these amazing ball players, mm-hmm. but they looked so odd, in effect, at the time, that they drew big crowds.
Wow. Yeah. Well, I don't know them, so I have to do some research.
The House of David, that's a...
They took it from David, from the Bible, from the Old Testament, but they were not Jewish themselves. So, but I would love to know if Lippman Pike's name comes up at all in this. It would be very interesting.
Yeah.
It would be interesting.
So I'm interested in what baseball was before people were supposed to be paid to play. So,
well, it developed out of cricket, which was, you know, the European game came over. But you know, I talk a little bit about this in the afterward. You know, the myth of Abner Doubleday and you know the rules is really a myth. You know, it was a game that developed over hundreds of years. I think there's a new book out by John Thorne.
By John Thorne,
where he's and I haven't read it yet, but I think he's discovered some. References to baseball going back much earlier even than we tend to think of it now.
Right.
So I think it was, you know, it was a game that was played, you know, with basic cricket rules that developed in the American society. It really did a lot to spread during the Civil War because a lot of the Brooklyn, which was the center of the league and the team, you know, they had half the teams in the first league were from Brooklyn, and then there were a few outlying teams. But when a lot of the Brooklyn players were drafted at the time, were fighting in the Civil War, they tended to they started spreading it in the various camps that they were at, and that's really how it spread out.
But the idea
the country.
Is that it was a hobby for the players.
Yeah, it was. It used to be. It used to be local clubs. So it was young men who, after work, would get together and they would form clubs. And just about every neighborhood had their own club, and they would play various ball, you know, games of ball. And when they started, then they started playing each other. And for a while, for years, there were different rules. So the clubs would argue as to whose rules to follow, and eventually the rules that we know today were really, you know, just became the ones most used, and it kind of continued from there, and then it, you know, it became codified after it started becoming a paid sport. And then they started building stadiums because... People would come, you know, fans would come. They would charge 50 cents to, you know, to watch. And when it became popular in the neighborhoods was when they started building these enclosed parks because all of a sudden they said, oh, let's see, if we can get people to pay to come in, it's going to be harder to get them to pay if we're out in the park. And that was the beginning of the enclosed ballparks. So...
as a Jewish ball player, did he play on the Sabbath?
I don't know, actually. I haven't been able to find any. Well, my answer to that is I haven't been able to find any box scores from Saturday games. So I'm not sure. That'll be in the next edition. I'm sure somebody out there will call and tell me. One of the things that's interesting about writing a book, that's the first book on a subject, and traveling all over to talking about them, is that I do run into various people who have bits of information that, they'll read about the book and they'll email me or they'll invite me down and say, I knew somebody in this congregation. I knew. So my guess is that, you know, I'm learning more and more about him as I travel on. But I don't know what the, you know, we wouldn't be worried about Friday nights particularly because there were no night games. And in general, you know, most of the players at the beginning would play, you know, would either play during breaks during the day, they take lunch and play, and, you know, that's how the rules had to evolve, you know, it had to fit into the various days. But I'll get back to you.
Did in your research, did anything ever come up about any ancestors of his?
We go back, obviously, once we're one generation behind, we're in Holland, and my wife, who speaks Dutch, I intend the next time you're over there to do some extra research for me, but we actually have some friends over in Holland, and we just sent some books over there. It's really hard, even at the time, to get a lock on how many kids were in Lip's family itself over here, because the records were very spotty. Often names were changed. We're not sure, or I'm not sure, and the record books, I think, aren't sure whether Joshua Pike is the same person as Israel Pike. You know, we know that there was another son, but, you know, he might have been called in one box Israel Pike because he was a Jewish fellow. Things weren't as definite as they are today. I think he had a sister, but I haven't been able to find this out. And that helps focus you on the book, too. There's, you know, when you're writing a book like this, certainly you do all your research. And then the hardest part is, because you've done all this work and you know so much about the time, and all of a sudden you want everybody to know just how smart you are and how hard you worked, the most difficult part about writing a children's book is leaving out all the great little tidbits that you know or that you've learned that that weaken the story. Because in the end, the book lives or dies on the story. The kids, you know, certainly the baseball is part of it. But most kids who are reading this book, they have to get to love Lip and to know him and root for him.
Right.
And so you end up, you know, Boaz, what we know, played in the major leagues. He ended up with a much smaller role in the book than maybe he had in Lip's life as his older brother, because I needed to focus on my main character. And we only have so many words in a book like this. So you really do narrow it down. In many ways, it's helpful because you have to find the core of your subject and what's really important. And for me, I have to find, well, exactly as you asked me before, what do I want people to take away from this book? And the most important thing for me was to communicate Lip's love for the game, how he wasn't going to let anything stop him. This was his dream. Even though everything was stacked against him, he was going to follow his dream. And that love is what I want to come through. And then that he did change the game. He really made an impact. So anything that was extraneous to that really had to go.
Right. And I actually have a question about a children's book in general. Mm-hmm. when you write a children's book, do you do all the writing and then the illustrator comes in?
Most people don't understand how it works. Most writers have no say whatsoever onto who illustrates your book.
Oh, really?
In fact, it's fairly standard in the industry that most writers and illustrators don't meet each other until the book's published and they're doing publicity tours.
Wow.
Basically, I write my story, I sell it. Once it's sold, the publisher, they own the story. Then they go out and they hire the illustrator. So we generally don't talk. Or if we do talk, it's through the editor, who in a sense is making an arranged marriage. For me, because as you mentioned, my day job is I have a gallery and I handle the original work of a lot of artists and illustrators. I do know some of the illustrators who have worked, who have done my other books. I've never met Zachary.
You haven't met him?
Have not met him. And I don't believe we've even spoken on the phone. We've emailed back and forth, certainly. But I've become very close friends with some of my other illustrators. My book Across the Alley is illustrated by E.B. Lewis. And I'll put in a plug for that. That's about a little Jewish boy and a little black boy who aren't allowed to play with each other, but their bedroom windows face each other and they become best friends at night. The little black boy's dad wants him to be a baseball player, and the Jewish fellow's dad wants him to play the violin, but they're both better at each other's thing. Mm-hmm. So they become best friends and they teach each other their specialties, and then the question is whether they're willing to bring their friendship out in the open and whether their fathers or grandfathers are willing to accept that. And that's got some wonderful baseball images by E.B. Lewis, who was hired by the publisher, but the publisher didn't realize E.B. and I were good friends at the time, so we did get to work together. So in general, it's not a collaboration in that sense. It's, my story's done, and then I see it again when it's a beautiful book. I love what Zach's done here. And again, more than most writers, my editor will often run the names by me because they know how invested I am in the world of illustration. But the idea between keeping us apart, because I know a lot of people think that's odd, is that it's an equal collaboration. And what you don't want the author doing is telling the illustrator how to do their job. They should be wearing red pants, or this should look more like that. The illustrator needs to bring their own life to it. And if the book really works, it's a true collaboration.
Very interesting. I always assumed it was like Rodgers and Hart sitting in a room yelling at each other or something. But interesting.
Yeah, no, we yell in the rooms by ourselves saying, I wish I could talk to them.
Yeah.
Professional team. Mm-hmm. So I was just wondering on what specific evidence you want to cover, which you can make the claim that Lupin Pipe was the first professional ball player.
Well, the simple answer to that is it's a bit of hype, certainly. There's no way to know exactly who was the first person to accept money to play. What we do know is that Lip was the first person accused of accepting money to play, the first person that the newspapers claimed was accepting money to play. And so he became known during his time as the first ball player paid to play. Certainly, as soon as it became above board, many other players were being paid as well. So the simple answer is that on the Cincinnati Red Stockings team of 1869. Do we assume that players were being paid? Yeah, I think we can assume that players were being paid, but they weren't allowed to be paid. So Lip was really the lightning rod that made that switch because he was brought up on charges. It basically forced the hand of the owners to acknowledge that, yes, there were professionals playing on amateur teams. At the beginning, most of the teams were primarily amateur, and then they would bring in a couple of ringers, as it were, to beat, you know, the other neighborhoods. But it really was primarily amateur.
I thought the Ken Burgess documentary to be applied is that the Cincinnati team were, they had signed contracts to play. They were openly professional.
Right, but there was no professional league per se. I mean, it didn't exist yet. So, you know, why Lip was the one, you know, who was accused. You know, things were going on, certainly, behind doors.
Well, when he was playing in the professional leagues, what was his, did you come across evidence as to what he was paid?
He was paid $20 a week to come go to Philadelphia. So we know that. I did Google that quickly. I think it comes to about $350 today. A week.
Did you find what other guys were being paid?
His dad had offered him, if he were to stay in the haberdashery, had offered him $2 a day, and which was good money at the time, because they were worried about him leaving town, and that's when he admitted that he actually had a better deal elsewhere, and he'd follow his own dream.
Did you find out what other guys were? Once it became clear that other guys were getting paid, were there any records of?
I haven't done that research to see how quickly they started saying, "Well, wait a second, he's getting paid this. I want more."
Right.
Yeah. At that point, it's not relevant to my story.
Your book, and, yeah. Yeah. Maybe Ken Burns will work on that.
There we go.
Yeah. Any other questions from our crew tonight? All right, well, I would like to just, there's a little quote from the Sporting News eulogy about Lip, and it's, "Lip Pike was one of the baseball's greatest sluggers and one of the baseball players who was always gentlemanly both on and off the field." And I think in your book, you got that across quite well, and I think that can hold true for you on and off the field as well. It's
thank
been
you
a
so
pleasure
much.
Getting to meet you. And thank you so much for coming. It's Richard Michelson, the author of Lipman Pike, America's First Home Run King, illustrated by Zachary Pullen, who one day Richard may meet.
And hi, Zach.
And the book is published by Sleeping Bear Press. And thanks again, Rich. We
thank
really
you. Absolute
appreciate
pleasure
it.
Getting to meet you, and I hope to be back someday.
Thank you.